We shall turn now to the Word of God together, the Epistle of James, chapter 5. James chapter 5, we may read just now from verse 7. James 5, verse 7, "Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth, and hath long patience for it, until he receive the early and latter rain. Be ye also patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draweth nigh. Grudge not one against another, brethren, lest ye be condemned. Behold, the judge standeth before the door. Take, my brethren, the prophets who have spoken in the name of the Lord for an example of suffering, affliction, and of patience. Behold, we count them happy which endure. Ye have heard of the patience of Job, and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy," and so on. May God again bless the reading of his word. We come now to this part of the epistle of James, and as you read the verses that we read, you will notice, I trust, that he is stressing, he's emphasizing the importance of the exercising of this grace of patience. You will see that five times just in these verses that we read, he repeats this word, patience, or patient. And it is to be noted that although at the beginning of the epistle, in chapter 1, he speaks of patience there, in verse 2 of chapter 1, he writes, "My brethren, count it all joy when ye fall into diverse temptations, knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience, but let patience have her perfect work, that ye may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing." Now I know on the surface of things, as you read these verses, and then you go to chapter 5, it would seem on the surface of things that James is speaking of the same thing. The words are different. Although they are translated patience, the words in the original are different. And what James is talking about here in this fifth chapter is more as long-suffering or bearing long. Patience in the first chapter is the acceptance, as it were, of God's purposes, God's sovereign purposes, the acceptance of them, acquiescing in them, waiting upon the Lord to work out his purpose, trying the faith by his workings. But here in this chapter 5, you will see that what James writes about is particularly to do with the relationship between believers. You will see in verse 7, he writes, "Be patient therefore, brethren." Now in the previous verses, we noted when we were looking at them that James is warning these rich men who are living in pleasure but are cheating their slaves or their servants, who are ill-treating them or abusing them, who are extortionate. And James warns them that God, who is the judge, will eventually deal with them and judge them for their dishonesty and so on. And it is clear from the previous verses that what James has in mind is the suffering of his brethren, the scattered saints, suffering at the hands of those who do not know God, or those who are outside in the world, the ungodly. Now in verse 7, he comes to something that in many respects is even more serious. He's now coming to deal with responses to behavior or reactions to conduct. Be patient, therefore, brethren. In verse 6, he writes, this is the rich, ye have condemned and killed the just, and he doth not resist you. Be patient, therefore, brethren. And though he has condemned the abuse that his brethren are experiencing, he now comes to deal with that very, very important issue of how they who are abused, how they who are ill-treated, how they who are exploited, how they react. You know, so often we concentrate upon actions, and they're important, and how Christians should act, how they should behave. But we need to understand that God is very interested in how his children react to given circumstances and given situations. And what James is writing is intended that it would be searching, that it would be convicting, that we would be inquiring, well, how do I react when this happens? When that happens, when someone ill-treats me, when someone abuses me, how do I react? That's what James is coming to now. And he's telling these, his brethren, be patient, be long-suffering, endure it. That's how you are to respond, not getting angry, not becoming abusive toward those who are ill-treating you, but you are to be patient, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. And that's the first thing that we may note. James's encouragement to patience. And as I said, it's a different word. It particularly means, you will see in the context, long-suffering, or suffering long. In verse 9, James writes, grudge not one against another, brethren, lest ye be condemned. Behold, the judge standeth before the door. Take, my brethren, the prophets who have spoken in the name of the Lord for an example of long-suffering affliction. Affliction that lasts, an affliction that seems to have no end. He says, take, for example, the prophets. My brethren, isn't it interesting that here's James in the first century, and he's making reference to the prophets in the Old Testament many, many centuries before, and he speaks of them as his brethren, indicating clearly the unity of the family of God, the household of faith. The Old Testament saints, the New Testament saints, they all belong to the one great spiritual family. And here he's saying, if you want an example of how the saints of God ought to react, well, then he says, go to the prophets as examples of long-suffering affliction. You see, patience is waiting. We wait patiently for something that we have an expectation for, and we wait for it, fully convinced in due course we will receive it, and we're patient because of that. But what James is talking about here is affliction, the experience that is painful. that is grieving. And he is saying here, when the children of God find themselves in these circumstances, this is when God expects them to be patient. He expects them to manifest patience in affliction or long-suffering. It's as though they cannot see any light in the tunnel, perhaps. Everything seems gloomy and dark. Nevertheless, they wait patiently upon the Lord. And when he's exhorting them to wait, going back to verse 7, he says, "Be patient therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord." And of course he's referring there to the parousia, the second coming of the Lord. "Behold," he says, "the husbandman waiteth for the precious fruit of the earth, and hath long patience." He waits long for it until he received the early and latter rain. And you know that in the East, as of course in many other parts of the world, when the farmer goes out to sow a seed, he puts the seed in the ground, but he knows perfectly well it's not going to grow. It's not going to be productive. It will not produce anything unless he gets rain. But he has no control over the rain. He doesn't know when God is going to send it. But he plants the seed in hope. And he is planting it ready and willing to wait until God's time. He will send the rain to make the seed to germinate, begin to grow. But then even when it grows, he has to wait for the latter rain that the grain, the ears will fill out and that he will have a harvest. But he doesn't know when God is going to send the latter rain. That all depends on the sovereign plan and purpose of God. And James is writing and he is telling these, his brethren, you have to act in the same way. You have to trust God. And even if you're tried long and the affliction doesn't lift away and you're having to carry that burden, he says, nevertheless, you must wait and you must wait for God. And in verse 8 he says, "Be ye also patient." And the farmer might go out and he looks at his field. The seed is lying under the ground and it's unproductive. And he's wondering, well, when will God send the rain? And he's looking heavenward, but he knows perfectly well until God sends it, I must wait. And yet he has that confidence in his own time, God will send it. And in his own time, he will send the latter rain as well. Be patient, establish your hearts. And you'll see how important this is. The heart established, thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in thee. The farmer is patient, but he's at peace because he's trusting in the Lord who does not fail him. And his heart is established. He's not upset. He's not distressed. He's not anxious. He's prepared to wait God's time. His heart is established. He's content to wait on God. But then he goes on to deal with something else that's of importance. Be patient under affliction, under trial. But you see, the church and the saints of God have trials from two directions. Ultimately, they all have their origin with the devil himself. But here, you see, James moves from the afflictions and the trials that come from outside, that come from the ungodly, who are living in pleasure, who are not interested in God's providence, who are not seeing if God will, we will do this or that. They think they're in control of everything. And they think they can treat God's children any way they want. But notice what James now comes to. Verse 9. Grudge not one against another, brethren, lest ye be condemned. What James is talking about is something that God disapproves of and will condemn. And what is it? Grudge not one against another, brethren. He's talking about this spirit that may exist between brethren in the very household of faith. Grudge not one against another. And you see, we may indeed have things that we experience from outside, from the ungodly, and there may be grievous, and we may bear it patiently, but then you see, when it comes within, into the family, into the church, well, you expect differently, don't you? Because out there in the world, they don't have grace. They don't even claim to have grace. But inside, the brethren claim to have grace. That makes a difference. And therefore, our expectations from the brethren are different. We expect that grace makes a difference, that it alters conduct, that it changes attitudes. And therefore, you see, James says that God disapproves, he condemns this attitude found amongst the people of God where they carry grudges one against another. And James says, behold, the judge standeth before the door, the one who judges, the one who knows, the one who sees, the one who understands. And how often it is the case, maybe some of the people of God, because of events or circumstances, situations that have developed in their relationships, they carry grudges and they won't forgive and they carry a grudge in their heart. You see, a grudge, carrying a grudge isn't like carrying a burden on your shoulders. It's carried in the heart. It's carried internally. It's something that it can't be defined so easily, but it is there. And it affects thinking. It affects attitudes. It affects relationships. And James is saying, grudge not one against another. So that the children of God, his brethren, are to examine themselves. Well, there's that brother, and he did this to me, and he did that to me, and I'm not going to forget it, and I'm not going to forgive him. Or there is that woman, and she did this, or said that, or acted this way or that way, so I'm not going to forget it, and I'm not going to overlook it, and I'm not going to forgive. And this is what James is talking about, that God does not approve of such an attitude. And you might think, well, is God not a God of justice? Does God take any delight in seeing his people ill-treated? Of course he doesn't. And that is why James says, the judge standeth before the door. The judge who will do what's right. It's interesting, going back to the chapter that we read, Lamentations chapter 3, and perhaps even before we read it, if you go to the prophecy of Jeremiah himself, these are the Lamentations of Jeremiah, but in chapter 20, of Jeremiah's prophecy, he is brought so low in his spirit. Listen to him as he addresses God, Jeremiah 20, verse 7. O Lord, thou hast deceived me, and I was deceived. Now you just imagine talking to God like that. Jeremiah is truly low in his spirit when he is saying here, thou hast deceived me. Now God doesn't deceive anyone. But Jeremiah, you see, is obviously one whose hopes have been dashed. He's one who entered the service of God as the prophet of the Lord, taking hold of the promises of God, because God had said to him, even before he was born, God had set him apart from the womb to be a prophet, to carry his word to the people. And yet here he says, I was deceived. Thou art stronger than I and hast prevailed. I am in derision daily. Everyone mocketh me. Now, what does James write? Take for an example the prophets, my brethren the prophets, as an example of long-suffering and affliction. And here is Jeremiah, I am in derision daily. I didn't expect this. I went to proclaim God's word, to be truthful to God, to be truthful to the people. I thought they would listen. I thought they would hearken to the message, but I am in derision daily. Everyone mocketh me, for since I speak, I cried out. I cried violence and spoil, because the word of the Lord was made a reproach unto me and a derision daily. Then I said, here's the conclusion he comes to, I will not make mention of him, nor speak any more in his name. Imagine that. He's telling God, I've had enough. I'm not going to speak any more, because every time I speak, I'm only in trouble. And therefore, he says, I will speak no more. But his word was in mine heart as a burning fire shut up in my bones, and I was weary with forbearing, and I could not stay. What here Jeremiah is saying is this. It was even worse. I said, I'm not going to speak anymore, but the word of God had been planted in my heart and in my soul, and it's like a burning fire waiting to break out, and therefore it's worse for me to be silent. Now, I just draw attention to these words, because Jeremiah was one of those prophets of whom James is speaking, who came to this state and condition, like Elijah also, a man who was subject to like passions as we are, and he wanted to die, he'd had enough. This is the lot and the portion of so many of God's servants down through history. Now in chapter 3 of Lamentations, here's the prophet lamenting. Lamenting not just over his own particular condition and God's dealings with him as an individual, but his dealings with the people that he ministered the word to. And yet there is something very important that he says in verse 38 of this chapter 3, Lamentations 3, verse 37. Who is he that saith, and it cometh to pass, when the Lord commandeth it not? That's a very interesting question, isn't it? Who is he that saith, and it cometh to pass, when the Lord commandeth it not? People get ideas. Well, the Lord would have me do this and have me do that, and he's directing me to do this and telling me to do that. All sorts of ideas. Who is he that saith, and that when the Lord commandeth it not? And then this is what he says, verse 38. Out of the mouth of the Most High proceedeth not evil and good. How important that is. Out of the mouth of the Most High proceedeth not evil and good. When someone tells you, the Lord's directing me to do this or to do that, telling me to do this, to do that, and they're doing it in an evil fashion, or they're doing it in an unbiblical or in an unchristian fashion, then you can be sure that it is not from the Lord. Because out of the mouth of the Most High proceedeth not evil and good. If God directs us to do anything, it will always be done in a good fashion or according to His character, His mind. It will always be done in a gracious, Christian, biblical fashion. Let no one deceive you by saying, oh, but I'm doing the will of the Lord, and they're doing it in an evil fashion. That didn't come from the Lord. But then in addition, the one who's speaking here is greatly in affliction. And he is saying in verse 22, it is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed, because His compassions fail not. If it weren't for God's compassions, we would perish. That's what he's really saying. But then in verse 25, he says, the Lord is good unto them that wait for Him, to the soul that seeketh Him. It is good that a man should both hope and quietly wait for the salvation of the Lord. It is good. Now, isn't that something? Here's Jeremiah, sore tried, ready to give up, fainting because of all that he's having to endure. The people are not responding. They're not repenting, they're not turning to the Lord, and he thinks it's all a waste of time. But then he comes to this, well, the Lord is good unto them that wait for Him. And he is now aware, well, I need to learn to wait. I need to be long-suffering. I need to wait in affliction. It is good that a man should both hope and not just wait, but quietly wait. Quietly wait for the salvation of the Lord. How often the people of God, they become frustrated, they become anxious, they become troubled. Not only do they upset themselves, but they upset others, because they feel the need, I need to say something, I need to do something, I need to act, I need to vindicate myself, I need to do this, that, the other. Here's Jeremiah, and he's learning this important lesson. It is good. It is really good spiritually. It's good for the individual, it's good for the child of God, that a man should both hope and quietly wait for the salvation of the Lord. Why? Because going back to verse 38, out of the mouth of the Most High proceedeth not evil and good. And you see, sometimes we forget this. When God has a purpose for His children, collectively or the individual, does He ever have an evil purpose? Does He ever have a wrong purpose? Does He ever have a purpose that He cannot justify? You see, God always purposes good, never anything else, for His children. That's why they are to wait. Wait quietly because they know this, his purpose is good. There's no mixture, there's no evil mixed in with the good. It's all good, 100% good. And you see, this is what the child of God has to learn, and this is what enables them to wait patiently. They know this, that however evil it may appear on the surface to me, it is 100% good. That's it. It's perfectly good. There's a good purpose, a good plan. Everything's functioning as God purposes it. And he only intends good for his child. They may be afflicted. They may have to learn to patiently wait and to wait quietly without any murmuring, without any complaining. Wait quietly, patiently upon the Lord because they know this. Behind all this is the good purpose of the Lord. He's not trying to harm me. He's not trying to do me harm. He only intends to do me good. And that's why when we go over to James, he uses the prophets, we just referred to one of them, as examples of being patient in affliction. Because they learn this. It is good to be patient and to wait quietly God's time because he only purposes good. Nothing else. There's no mixture of evil. And that's how the devil would tempt the people of God to think, oh, if we could remove this or that or the other element, then we would make it good ourselves. But God has it all perfectly fitted together for good. But we must hasten on. James then, not only does he use the prophets as examples of suffering affliction and of patience, but he goes on in verse 11 to say, behold, we count them happy which endure. And then here's an example of one who happily endures. Ye have heard of the patience of Job and have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. Now, some time ago we went through Job. And we all know of the severity of his trials. Job became desperate. He just could not understand, what is God doing? And it seems I'm left in darkness. I can't figure out what God's doing. Can't understand it. But I do know this, he knows the way that I take. And when he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. And here is mention of Job as one of the examples of patiently waiting in affliction. And although he didn't understand what God was doing, God understood what he was doing. He understood perfectly what he was doing. He was applying his eternal wisdom, his infinite knowledge in the case of Job. And what do we see? What does James say? Ye have seen the end of the Lord, that the Lord is very pitiful and of tender mercy. Now does that mean that God was pitiful after he had afflicted Job? That he was feeling sorry for Job that he had afflicted him so much? Or that he had permitted Satan to deal with him so severely? That's not what it means. What it means is this. All the time that God was permitting Satan to afflict Job, and all the time that Job was sitting in that ash heap, scraping his boils with a piece of broken pottery, all the time that he was suffering mentally and psychologically and spiritually the whole time, God was very pitiful. God felt for Job. He felt for him. He felt with him. Now that is something that we can easily forget. God does have feelings toward his people. And all the time that poor Job is crying out, God was pitying him. But the pity of God is wise pity. It is heavenly, holy pity. It is edifying, constructive pity. And so all the time that God was dealing with Job or allowing Satan to afflict him as he did, God was pitying Job, feeling for him. It was as though God could say, Job, I know what you feel. I know what you're going through. I know what your emotions are like. I know the internal feelings you have. And I know that no one can understand you. I pity you, Job, but I'm not going to withdraw my hand until the work is finished. I feel for you, Job, but because I intend good, I will not lift my hand until the work is finished. And that's, you see, very often what we have to learn. And we might be thinking, as the psalmist was tempted to think, God has deserted me. God has abandoned me. He has forsaken me. Job might have been tempted to think, well, I cry out, God doesn't answer. I'm in desperation. Oh, that I knew where I could find him. And God was looking on. But Job, I haven't finished with you yet. And when I have finished, you will be a different man. When I have finished, Job, then you will be shining like the gold that has come out of the furnace. I feel for you, Job, but I'm going to complete the work. And let us never doubt God's kindness. Never let us doubt God's goodness. Never let us doubt the pity of God. And the next time that you may feel downcast and harassed by the devil and be thinking, well, will God lift this trial or this burden or take it away? Remember this, God, he pitied Job, he's very pitiful. Very pitiful. No other pity is like it. But even when he pities, he will carry on the work that brings forth the fruit of the Spirit. And when the devil tempts you to think God has abandoned you, he's a liar. He's very pitiful. But even that pity is a wise pity. It is a good pity. He feels, but he will not give up his work because it's a purpose for good. And this is what James is telling these his brethren. He is not only just bringing before them examples of the prophets and their long suffering and their patiently bearing an affliction, but he is telling us that Job, his experience was also exemplary, but it was a revelation, not just to Job, but a revelation to you and me and to all the saints of God, of what is in the heart of God. The very heart of God is a heart full of pity and compassion and love and affection, so that he works everything perfectly together for good to them that love him And therefore he says, brethren, grudge not one against another. And in the context, it would seem, you see, that some of the saints, some of the brethren, were suffering for the faith. And they were suffering for their steadfastness, just like the prophets did when they sought to be faithful to God. But the danger was, you see, that some were not suffering as much as others. And then the danger would be that those who suffered more would become envious of those who suffered less. And then they might begin to judge and think, well, obviously, he's not suffering so much, she's not suffering so much, because they're not as faithful. They're not as true. That's why they're suffering less. And James is saying, God will judge this. That is not a right attitude. That is a wrong attitude. Grudge not one against another. Don't start judging one another as though that you feel I'm more spiritually minded. I must be nearer to God than him. I must be walking closer to Christ than her because I am suffering so much. God is dealing with me and God is advancing his work in me, but he's neglecting them. James says that is not how you are to live and how you are to relate to one another. You are to bear what God sends in his providence to you as an individual. That's as, remember the Savior said to Simon Peter, what is that to thee? Follow thou me. You mind your own business. Peter, you concentrate in following me. Don't you start interfering or thinking, well, what's John doing? John's having an easier time than me. John's having a more prosperous time than me. John's living longer than I'm living and so on. Jesus said, you leave John to me. You follow me. That's what James is really saying here. Every child of God is to follow the path that God has planned for them. And if it is one of trial and tribulation, they are not then to think, well, God is being unjust, or God is not being true. He's not dealing fairly with us all as we should. No, he says, God is very pitiful, and very pitiful and of tender mercy. There's a tenderness in the heart of God that can't be found anywhere else. A tenderness in the heart of God toward his children. As a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him. And therefore, in the dark days that we live in, when the saints of God are tried in many ways, as individuals, we may find ourselves tried and our faith tested, and we might be thinking, when is God going to take away this trial? When is God going to lift this burden? God is very pitiful, and he's very merciful, and his heart goes out to his children all the time, in every situation. And the next time when you would be ready to murmur, ready to complain, look into the heart of God, as here we read, he is of tender mercy. He has the tenderest heart for his children and his afflicted children. But we shall leave it there. May the Lord bless his word.